Yesterday, I saw many of you just up the street. We gathered on the sidewalk along Midkiff next to the mall, right next to the busy traffic, with some signs. We gathered for a demonstration of solidarity with the Women's March on Washington. You probably heard about the Women's March. In addition to gathering in D.C., women and people of all genders gathered in hundreds of cities across the country and across the globe, on every continent, even Antarctica. It's Antarctica. People estimate so far that almost 3 million people gathered in the U.S. alone. It's being called the largest one-day protest in U.S. history. I know that Sally, our board president, who's back with the kids, marched in Austin with her daughter yesterday. And our newest member, Anna Paradox, marched in Albuquerque. Here's one of the posters for the March on Washington. I, along with a couple members here, had decided we were going to go to a march in Alpine yesterday. They were having a march there. But then we learned that it wasn't a march, but a hike through the hills, and that it was going to be really, really raining. So I reluctantly entertained again the crazy idea I had had a few weeks ago, but had pushed away out of fear and fatigue. Could we do something here in Midland, Texas? I asked a few people, is this a crazy idea? They said no, do it. This was on Thursday. Yes, this past Thursday. I didn't think that we as a church had the time to decide whether we wanted to sponsor it as a church, but I did ask permission to post it on our church Facebook page. And please, if you didn't get the word, I'm sorry. And if you didn't come, please don't feel guilty. This is not to make anyone feel guilty. I made a Facebook page for the event. I emailed the information to some local connections. I informed the press. And then I worried and worried and fretted and fretted. I worried that I would mess it up. One reason I had pushed away the thought those several weeks ago is that I knew I didn't have the energy or the time to plan it the way it really needed to be done. And now, 2 days away, I really didn't have the energy and time to plan it the way it needed to be done. Ideally, I would find some additional organizers so I wouldn't be doing it all by myself. I knew it would be a better event if I, yes, a woman, but a white, cisgender, privileged woman, weren't the only one at the helm. Last year, when we as a church organized our vigil for the shooting in Orlando, we partnered with gay, lesbian, transgender activists already active in the community. That's what made that such a successful event last year. I knew that a successful demonstration would need women of color, for example, in leadership, women with disabilities, transgender people. But I knew I didn't have yet enough of those connections here in Midland to mobilize that quickly. So I fretted, should I just not do it all? What was I overlooking with just my perspective, my limited view? I fretted about the strategy. Was it the right time and the right place? Had I overlooked some detail? Would anyone show up? Would the numbers be so low that it would be demoralizing? I fretted about safety. The night before the demonstration, I got a Facebook friend request from someone I didn't know. I could tell it was because they had found me through the demonstration page. He had the Confederate flag as his profile photo. When I looked on his page, it was just full of hate. I said no to the friend request, but I started picturing our demonstration overtaken by huge trucks. Nothing against trucks, they're just big, so that's where my mind went. Trucks pulling up next to us in the parking lot, lining up, or driving up over the curb, people yelling at us, perhaps even assaulting us. What if there were children there? What if my child was there? I could feel that fear in my body. That night, I looked at my sleeping 2-year-old, and the fearful voices got stronger. Were we taking too big of a risk? Was this stupid and foolish? I fretted about all of these things. But I went to sleep holding on to the reminder that I would not be alone. Even if only one other person showed up, we would be together. And I went to sleep remembering all the people throughout history, known and unknown, who had taken much, much bigger risks. I went to sleep remembering the values, my Unitarian Universalist values, that compel me to show up, my belief in inherent worth and dignity of every person, my belief that no one is free when some are oppressed, my belief that the universe does bend toward justice, my belief that there is a love that holds us. I went to sleep. When I woke up the next morning, I felt ready and hopeful. And then, not just one person showed up, not just 10 people showed up, but over 75 people showed up. Women, men, white, black, brown, couples, friends, children, an Episcopal priest, grandmothers, a Muslim man. And you know what? We received more joyful honks and cheers of solidarity than hecklers. I often hear people bemoan what it's like living in Midland, and I know. But this is Midland, too. And with more planning, we could have been many more in number. So, yes, it was just a demonstration. We were just standing on the sidewalk holding signs. But here are 5 reasons why taking to the streets is important. Credit for these goes to columnist and activist Courtney Martin. She says, 1, it's visceral. And as you think about these, know that taking to the streets obviously isn't the only way to act. There are many other things that meet all 5 of these. It's visceral. For so many of us, much of our lives is spent staring into screens, tapping away at keyboards, sending signals into an intangible universe of bits and bytes. It all adds up to something, surely, but sometimes that something can feel wildly disconnected from the someone, from us, who we really are, what we really care about, our bodies. Marching, demonstrating together is a chance to reclaim all of that, the corporeal, the relational, the sensorial. 2, it's visual. Where there's a photo op, there's a story. Where there's a story, there's power. 3, it's restorative. There's little else that can make the hardened heart supple again, like pounding your feet into the streets, beside perfect strangers joined in common cause. Marching side by side, smiling at one another, singing spontaneous chants in unison, this is the stuff that realigns your backbone and gets you feeling courageous and in cahoots again. 4, it's playful. It's simple, it's unapologetic, it's almost childlike in its own strange way. And where there is play and joy, There is sustainability. This is going to be a long-haul fight, not a one-weekend affair. If we're going to keep going, we are going to need to laugh and dance and move. Number 5, it's effective. You know who else took to the streets? The Velvet Revolution, the Civil Rights Marchers, the Second Wave Feminists, and so many other movements that have won, if not reaching all of their aims, at least having transformed cultures, systems, and hearts and minds so dramatically as to be considered effective. And the work will continue. Again, it's one thing that we can do. You could call it the beginning, but it wasn't. It was one moment in a long, long line of people working for progress in so, so many varied ways. Because marching and demonstrating is not for everyone, and because we need a multi-pronged and ongoing approach to change by protesting, by organizing, by making art, by making donations, by dialoguing, by calling our representatives, by running for office, by volunteering. They're all important. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. I know so many of you do all of this already. So let this be an affirmation for your work, an encouragement. Let's keep pushing through that fear that we feel in our bodies, that resistance. Let's keep doing the things that aren't only difficult, but the things that bring us joy and community and solidarity. Because the journey is long, and as my Black and Latino friends say, we can't just act when it's trendy and rewarding. Indeed, some Black and Latino people have been saying in response to this march, the March on Washington, "Where were you before?" The Black activist Ijeoma Oluo lamented, "For all my Black and brown women who can't help but look at crowds of millions of women and wonder, where were you when our babies were being shot in the streets, locked away in prison, deported away from the only home they've known? For all my Black and brown women who can't help but imagine how many of their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters and husbands and partners could have been saved if our oppression and our murder could have inspired 1/10 of this level of action and care. For all of my Black and brown women who cried today, for all the opportunity lost, for all the people we lost waiting, fighting, crying, screaming, begging, for somebody to help." I think that's a perspective we need to hear, even if we are first defensive about it. And on the other hand, another Black woman, Alicia Garza, one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, posted yesterday saying, "But if we respond to new members of our movement with shame, will they come back?" So she was expressing a little bit more generosity, and I think both of those voices are valid. It's a both and. I have to ask myself to listen to these statements, to not fall so quickly into guilt or defensiveness, but self-reflection. For the truth is that when I personally am not as affected, when my visible identities do not make me as vulnerable, it is easy for me to fall into complacency, even complicity. As one woman said here in Midland yesterday, "Being brown has always been my sign. I don't get to put it down." That threat that I felt before that demonstration is just a taste of the threat that some people in our country tell us that they live with constantly at some level. And as the Black poet Audre Lorde said, and as applies to all of us humans, I am not free while any woman is unfree, even when her shackles are very different from my own. So I pledge to keep working, to keep learning, to keep pushing myself out of my comfort zone. So I know I've been preaching a lot of sermons lately on activism, on the political, as you could call it, under some definitions. And I assure you, I will start to balance out all of this talk on activism with some other topics. But I will say I won't ever divorce the spiritual or the religious from the social and the political. I won't get partisan. I will never tell you who to vote for. But I deeply believe that the religious, the spiritual, is intimately tied up with and completely inextricable from the ethical, the social, the political. And that's what my job is to bring to you. That's why you called me. And if anyone ever tells you that religion and politics should not mix, ask them, was Jesus not concerned with the political as he overturned the tables of the money changers, as he was called Lord, a title reserved for Caesar, as he sought to establish a new kind of kingdom in which enemies are loved and the marginalized are prioritized? Was Muhammad not concerned with the political as he overthrew the Arab tribal bonds and instead insisted that humans stood radically equal as the teeth in a comb? Was Rabbi Heschel not concerned with politics when he said that he was praying with his feet and marching for civil rights next to Martin Luther King? And when he said that he could not read his prayer book when every time he opened it, he saw images of the children of Vietnam burning in napalm? Was the Buddha not political when he personally went to the battlefield to prevent the outbreak of a war and encouraged the use of the democratic process and the Sangha, the community? Pagans. I've been seeing so many pagans recently posting online their explanations of why their spiritual path is inevitably intertwined with the socio-political, with how to create a better world. Spirituality should not ever be divorced from what it means to live in this world. The personal is always political, even if those connections remain hidden from us. We as Unitarian Universalists root out those connections. We see how the search for truth and meaning, one of our principles, is intimately connected with another principle, that of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. We cannot pretend, of course, that our human systems of government will ever completely solve our problems. But we can work to make them better embody our values. We can work to help each other better embody our values. I think that the truth is, even if Hillary Clinton had won the election, or some independent, I would have loved it if we still had 3 million people marching in the United States for women's rights, and the rights of LGBTQ people, and the rights of people of color, the rights of all. Because these marches were ultimately not about Trump. That's not what it was about. They were about the fact that this nation was supposedly founded as a country indivisible with liberty and justice for all. But in reality, that was only for white, whatever white meant back then, land-owning men. This foundational belief of our country that some lives don't matter is not distant history. It does not die so quickly. And the progress won so far has not come easy. There's an unfinished revolution waiting to be won. in our laws, in our systems, in our beliefs, and in our hearts. So we need that hurricane. May it be so.